Service today's message, we're going to look at the life of Saint Therese of Lisieux, a fairly modern day saint really, and we're in a series all about experiencing God in deeper ways. And this latter half of the series we're looking at different characters from the past, some distant past. We looked at somebody from the 16th century last week, and we're going to look at something a little bit more modern today, and likewise next week. So looking at characters though who are not perfect in any way, even though some of them are called saints, they're not perfect, but they're fellow strugglers with us. They've also been trying to struggle to experience the real meaning and purpose of life. What's life all about? And coming to some, I think, deep conclusions and very practical conclusions about living. And so we're going to look at these characters and sort of look at their life, their work, some of their writings, and try and absorb some of that and apply it into our own lives. So as I said, today we're looking at Saint Therese of Lisieux, and here's a picture of her. Just some quick comments about her life, a quick overview. I think we have a next slide which shows where she's from. Lisieux is in the north of France, Normandy, not far from that great nation just to the north across the English Channel. So she grew up very privileged to live that close, right? So that's where she's from. I think we have a next slide which shows just some little, a little summary of her life. She was born Marie-Françoise Thérèse Martin in 1873. If you sort of jump down a little bit, you'll see that she died of TB in 1897. So she was only 24, died very young. She's had a profound impact in a short life. She's one of the most popular saints, perhaps after Saint Francis. Her writing, we'll look at some of her writings a little bit later, particularly her autobiography, The Life of a Soul, has been translated into all kinds of languages and disseminated around the world. She's had a profound influence. She enters the Carmelite convent in Lisieux in 1888, aged 15. So she went there very young. She's also known for, this is kind of what she's famous for, she's known as Saint Therese of the Child Jesus and the Holy Face. A little strange name. We'll get into that a little bit later because there is some significance there. But that was her kind of formal name in the convent. Popularly though, she's known as the Little Flower, or the Little Flower of Jesus. And that's because flowers are very significant to her, both in terms of how it sort of nature formed some of her ideology, her spirituality, but also we'll read some excerpts in the ways that she kind of wanted to share love with other people. And she's known for what's become known as the Little Way. She used that term about three times, but it was sort of coined more after her death and as she became more famous. This Little Way, which is, in summary, and I'll sort of give the end away at the beginning here. In summary, the Little Way is all about the fact that we are absolutely, completely, 100% loved. That we are already loved. We can't do anything more to be loved. The divine identity is love. God is love, and we are completely loved. And that revelation meant that she could recognize that it's okay to be imperfect. None of us are perfect, but we are all accepted. And then that transformed her into realizing that, we can share that love. We can make it real. We can demonstrate it. We can incarnate it, if you like, through simple acts of kindness. Rather than trying to do big things, we can all do little things on this little way, which are still unbelievably significant. They incarnate the very presence of God in reality. And they have a transforming effect on other people. And they're an invitation to others into that same love. So it's kind of like giving up on or letting go. This a theme through this series is letting go or fasting from things. Well, this is kind of like fasting from greatness, if you like, or letting go of ambition for greatness and just surrendering to love and being content to be insignificant, right? So that's kind of a summary of the Little Way. She did not start out there, though. Right, there's a journey. We'll just talk a little bit about that journey for a moment. Her childhood, she grew up in the north of France. She didn't grow up in Lisieux, but moved there to the convent eventually. But she grew up in Normandy, and she had, I think it would be fair to say, a pretty sad but loving childhood. Okay, so her mother died when she was 4 years old, and that made that she was very close to her mother. Again, it seems like it was a very loving family. Lost her mother. There'd already been tragedy in the family that she hadn't experienced. She actually had 8 siblings, 4 of whom died. The other 4 were all sisters, and they all became nuns as well. So she had the loss of her mother at a young age, but then became very attached to her sisters who raised her, a couple in particular who she was very close to. And then one by one, they all went off to the convent, and she lost them. She missed them. She was also bullied at school. She seems like she was a pretty bright child, but she was a little weird, to be honest. I mean, if you read her writings, she is a little strange. And she was bullied. And so she had a kind of sad childhood in many respects. She was often sick. She died at a young age from a disease that suggests she probably wasn't really robust physically. But as a child, she was very sick. And she was, somewhat neurotic. It's hard to tell, but from her writing, she's quite honest about the fact that she had a somewhat obsessive personality. And that mixed with her religion, and she grew up in a very religious environment, very religious family. That mixed with her religion kind of created all sorts of guilt complexes and obsessions about her imperfections and trying to be better and trying to please God. And a lot of that comes out in her writings, and there's a real mixture, let's say, in her writings, because there's still throughout some of that sort of obsessive tendency that you see there, which feels a little toxic, but somehow this little way that emerges through her life sort of breaks through. And there were some reasons for that. There were some reasons why change happened in her life. So she, at the age of 15, goes to the convent. That was that's a story in itself. She from the age of 9, she wanted to go to the convent. That was one of the things she was obsessed about, and they turned her down and turned her down. She even had an audience with the Pope. I don't know how that happened exactly, and she pleaded with him, I want to go to the convent. He said, it'll work out someday. Anyway, eventually she gets into the convent at age 15, and she goes into the convent with this desire to be a saint. I want to be a saint. And she, I think we have a picture here of Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc was her inspiration. Not enough time to get into the life of Joan of Arc, but just an amazing figure in history. Joan of Arc died at the age of 19. She was burnt at the stake as a heretic. She fought against England, and the British were very responsible with their Burgundian allies for executing her. And she was kind of in disgrace, but then eventually she was rehabilitated and became a saint. But she was somebody that Saint Therese admired and just desperately wanted to emulate and do something big. I want to do great things. I want to make a difference in this world. I want to make a difference for God, etc., etc. So she goes into the convent with all these sort of enthusiasm. But life in the convent is no bed of roses. The monastic life, it's kind of unrealistic. It's cloistered away. It's away from the real world. Well, it is in many respects, obviously. But there's also stresses and strains of monastic life, of being in the convent. And she, it was a very cold, austere environment. They, for 7 months of the year, they would only eat one meal a day. Lots of chores to do. You weren't allowed to speak much during chores. It was kind of a pretty hostile environment. A lot of hard work. And a lot of hellfire and brimstone. Okay, so the atmosphere was a little toxic in that convent. Some of you who have been raised in maybe religious backgrounds or religious schools and that kind of thing might be able to identify with a little bit of that. But there was a lot of guilt, a lot of shame, a lot of do better, a lot of you're not good enough. And of course, that fed into Saint Therese's obsessive personality. And so she wrestled with all kinds of personal nightmares. And what I think it did to her, it was not only the people inside the convent, but there were visiting teachers and monks and nuns that would come and teach from the outside. They all seemed to have this hellfire and brimstone message. And it resulted really in a couple of things. One was that she felt incredibly guilty, felt so unworthy, it really diminished her self-esteem. But as often happens when we have low self-esteem or we experience that kind of neurosis ourselves, we can project that onto other people through criticism, right? We become very critical of the people around us because we're critical of ourselves, so we're critical of other people. And she was, you know, again, this comes through in some of her writing. She's sort of a little bit of a nitpicker, doesn't really feel that the other people around her are good enough either. They're kind of annoying and kind of difficult. And she just doesn't really like being at the convent. And so she's in a bit of a crisis. And there's a couple of things, though, that influence her in a different way. And that's sort of this crisis coupled with these more positive influences results in the emergence of this little way that she stumbles upon. The first thing is that she was a Carmelite nun. The Carmelites were a monastic order. They were founded in the 12th century on Mount Carmel in present-day Israel. Initially it was a male-only monastic order, and then eventually they allowed women into that order as well, which was so good of them. The Carmelites had a rich heritage of contemplative prayer. Teresa of Avila, who many of us may be familiar with, was a Carmelite. And she began reading Teresa, and Teresa was a mentor and a sort of a spiritual mother, if you like, to St. John of the Cross. So she began to read works like The Ascent of Mount Carmel by John of the Cross. And all these themes, all these writers, all these contemplatives, these mystics from the Carmelite tradition were all about union with God, the sort of union with the loving presence of God. The divine presence is love, and we have immediate access to that. So there was this loving kind of traditional influence in her life. And then eventually a Franciscan monk visits the convent, and he has this message of love and acceptance and forgiveness, that God loves us. And this transforms her. This is perhaps the turning point, it seems, in her life. She writes this about that visit by the monk. This is in her autobiography. Not that monk, the that's it. My soul was like a book which the priest read better than I did. He launched me full sail in the ways of confidence and love, which held such an attraction for me, but upon which I had not dared to venture. He told me that my faults did not offend God. Just imagine that, right? What if we all just accepted that reality, that our faults do not offend God? I mean, what a weight that would lift off our shoulders. And that's what happened with Therese, Saint Therese. Therese, as she was then, she wasn't a saint yet. This is like a weight lifted from her. And it was a real turning point. And so she, on the one hand, she felt very trapped in the monastery. She wanted to do great things, and she felt, I'm just stuck in this monastery with people I don't particularly like. And she was feeling guilty and all the rest of it. But this transformation meant that she realized, I am totally loved by God. I don't need to do anything big. I don't need to overcome all my faults. I mean, that's not a get out of jail free card, but it's like, perfection is probably not a sensible goal, right? None of us are perfect. None of us probably will be perfect. That doesn't offend God. I am completely loved, and I can love the people around me by doing small things. I can extend small kindnesses to the people around me as a way of incarnating this love, of demonstrating this love, of inviting people into this same experience of love. And that's what she set out to do, and she's recorded much of that journey in her autobiography, which is called The Story of a Soul. Again, been widely translated and read around the world. And we're going to let's look at a few excerpts on that. I'm going to read a section from that said book, which I think kind of captures some of what this story that we're talking about here. And then we'll look at some other shorter quotes. And the material for today, we have a workbook for the series, so grab a copy of that out on the welcome desk if you don't have one, or you can download it online. There's lots of excerpts from her writings, mainly from her autobiography. We also have poems and letters and stories recounted by her sisters and other people after her death. But most of what we know about Saint Therese comes from her autobiography. But do check out the material. And there's some interesting practices for this week about the little way, about doing small things with great love In everyday life, and that being that mattering, that counting, that being actually the way of Jesus. His center is, you know, I have always wanted to become a saint. Unfortunately, when I have compared myself with the saints, I have always found that there is the same difference between the saints and me as there is between a mountain whose summit is lost in the clouds and a humble grain of sand trodden underfoot by passers-by. Instead of being discouraged, I told myself, God would not make me wish for something impossible, and so in spite of my littleness, I can aim at being a saint. It is impossible for me to grow bigger, so I put up with myself as I am, with all my countless faults. But I will look for some means of going to heaven by a little way, which is very short and very straight, a little way that is quite new. We live in an age of inventions. Okay, so she was alive at the end of the 19th century. We need no longer climb laboriously up flights of stairs in well-to-do houses. There are lifts. And I was determined to find a lift to carry me to Jesus. For I was far too small to climb the steep stairs of perfection. Anybody feel like that? I'm just too small to climb the steep stairs of perfection. So I sought in Holy Scripture some idea of what this lift I wanted would be. And I read these words from the very mouth of eternal wisdom. Whosoever is a little one, let him come to me. I drew nearer to God, fully realizing that I had found what I was looking for. I also wanted to know how God would deal with a little one. So I continued my search and found this. This is in Scripture. You shall be carried at the breasts and upon the knees as one whom the mother caresseth. So will I comfort you. It's a wonderful female metaphor for God there. Never before had I been gladdened by such sweet and tender words. It is your arms, Jesus, which are the lift to carry me to heaven. And so there is no need for me to grow up. In fact, just the opposite. I must stay little and become less and less. So we have there, you know, I think that's classic Saint Therese. It's this beautiful simplicity. There's a sort of childlike simplicity to it. There's also a little sort of, maybe a hint of self-deprecation, right? Might pick that up. And I think some of that obsessiveness, maybe some of the sort of toxic religious thing aspect can bleed through at time. Again, nobody's perfect, right? Not even saints, believe it or not, are perfect. But there's something so beautiful about this. She truly seems to have been liberated from this weight of guilt, this weight of fear. Some other little quotes we'll flush up here. Some of these are in the material, as I mentioned. I think we've got some quotes first. Do we have a little? I applied myself especially to practice little virtues, not having the facility to perform great ones. Always littler, lighter, in order to be lifted more easily by the breeze of love. Okay, so this little way. Let's look at another one. And sorry, Sarah, I got out of order those. We'll go back to the other slide after this one. I will seek out a means of getting to heaven by a little way, very short and very straight. Love proves itself by deeds. So how am I to show my love? Great deeds are forbidden me. The only way I can prove my love is by scattering flowers. And these flowers are every little sacrifice, every glance and word, and the doing of the least actions for love. So there's this sharing of small things, little flowers, as she calls them. She uses another metaphor in this next quote. To the right and to the left, I throw to my little birds the good grain that God places in my hands. And then I let things take their course. I busy myself with it no more. Sometimes it is just as though I'd thrown nothing. At other times, it does some good. But God tells me, give, give always, without being concerned with the results. I think maybe we can go back to that slide there, Sarah. The list slide, yeah. So I try to sort of summarize this little way, this way of Saint Therese. Again, let's remember, she never really, I think, meant to have this official title to this little way. And these are just my musings on it, really. So there's nothing very official about this. But what struck me about the little way, what happened in the life of Saint Therese, is firstly, peace. Less self-judgment and pressure of performance for God or performance for other people. Like she reached a place of peace by just not worrying, letting go of guilt, letting go of fear, not worrying what people thought about her, or even what God thought about her, other than the fact that God is love. And so God thinks you are fantastic, right? That was her perspective. That sets us free to be aware, right? So she was aware of needs around her. She suddenly became more aware of the people around her, not as annoying people, but people with their own issues of fear and guilt and shame and difficulties. She became more aware because peace sets us free to notice the small things. Like if we're not at peace with ourselves, we tend to be more obsessed about ourselves, either trying to be better for ourselves or better for God or better than the person next to us. You know, it's all kind of relative. But when we're at peace, we're free to be just more naturally relaxed and outward. That leads then to servanthood, more simple acts of love and kindness to others. As we see those needs, as we become more aware, we can touch others' lives in simple ways. We don't have to solve every problem. We don't even necessarily have to control the outcome of our kindness. We're just kind. We just share small things with great love, and it has an impact that is beyond our own control. And then acceptance of others. So it's not just sort of proactively doing things for other people, but it's also this kindness is about the way we respond to people. People do things to us, right, passively or actively. And how do we respond to those? So do we react aggressively, defensively, or can we act in a more accepting way? Again, when we're at peace with ourselves, it's much easier, no matter what comes at us, to have less of a reaction to others' negative or annoying traits, right? And you may feel surrounded by people with negative and annoying traits, right? But how do we respond to that? Let me share another, this would be a final reading from Santeres, but share another piece here, which I think gets at that issue of it being about how we respond to somebody. Another time, I was in the wash house near a sister who constantly splashed me with dirty water as she washed the handkerchiefs. Nothing worse. My first impulse was to draw back and wipe my face so as to show her I would like her to work with less splashing. I told you it was a little weird, right? Then I at once thought how foolish I was to refuse the precious gifts offered me so generously, and I was very careful not to show my annoyance. In fact, I made such efforts to be showered with dirty water half an hour, and I had generally taken a fancy to this kind of novel aspersion. And I decided to turn up as often as I could to that lucky spot where so much spiritual wealth was freely handed out. Okay. Deep spiritual insights there, right? So, I laughed as well. You would read that, and there's many other things you laugh at. I mean, there's one point where she talks about wanting to be a toy for the child Jesus. She would just be like a bouncy ball. Didn't want to be a special toy because she just wanted to be a toy that Jesus didn't have to worry too much about. You know, it's kind of like, okay, she was very young, and there's some, you know, she's got some great imaginary leanings here. But that one, okay, makes you laugh on the one hand. But then think about it this way. Think about the ways we get splashed in everyday life, right? By maybe unknowingly by other people. Sometimes I think it's deliberate, right? People treat us badly. But a lot of times we get splashed and we just don't, react very well. We're like, you know, be more considerate. We're not very accepting. Now she could have said, excuse me, would you mind just not splashing too much? That might have been a very reasonable way to go as well, right? You know, could you just take out, you know, But she had some kind of revelation in that moment, some kind of epiphany in that moment, that it was like, okay, I think she saw that there's a deeper meaning to this. And so her non-reaction, her kind reaction, was an example of sharing these little flowers, these little seeds. This was an example of the little way. I just about 3 days ago, I was out walking my dog, and I came across this guy who was really aggressive to me about a year ago. I got a good memory though. So, and he was kind of, he actually got in my face, dropped the F-bomb at me it was about my dog actually. And it was really about his dog. That's another story. Anyway, he was just really, anyway, I ran into him again, I probably the first time for, maybe since then, maybe one other occasion I ran into him, but, and he tried to smile at me, and I just sort of looked at him and walked on. And I gave him the evil, the evils, you know. And I'm walking on, and I just suddenly thought, well, I won't use the word that I thought about myself at that point. I was like, why would you be like that? That was my, okay, so there's my response. That's my response, which is, that wasn't a little flower or a little seed of kindness. That was, I've got you pegged, you're a jerk, and you always will be. And it might, but don't we do that kind of thing so often, either mentally and and emotionally, but we don't really necessarily say it, but it kind of oozes out of us probably. What if we were just to let go of that and out of this place of peace, because we are so loved and we have nothing to lose, that we could let go and return, no matter what comes at us, with acceptance and love. That doesn't mean we don't have to push back at times. I think it would have been totally reasonable for Saint Teresa to have said, hey, just so you know, the splashing thing isn't really working for me. But she made it work for us, so that's a good thing. Let's just shift gears a little bit and talk about what I think are a couple of challenges from Saint Teresa. There are many, and I encourage you, read that book. It's actually an easy read. Look at the excerpts in the material this week. Do the practice in the material this week. But let's just for a moment ponder some of the challenges. I just want to focus on two challenges from the life of Saint Teresa. The first challenge is this issue of small things. Right, the issue of small things. Because at one level, I think we really buy it, right? We want to believe that we don't have to do great things, that small things really are the way. And probably most of us feel like, well, we only get to do small things anyway. Probably not many of us here feel great, like we are of real significance to the history of humanity. So at one level, we buy it. Mother Teresa was super influenced by Saint Teresa of Lisieux. And she's quoted as saying, not all of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. Very famous quote. I mean, and we all love Mother Teresa, right? So we're all good with that. Jesus embodied this and taught this. So, in Matthew's gospel, we read things, for instance, like, look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon, all his splendor, was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grasses of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So Jesus is saying, look, this God loves the small things. God loves the birds and the flowers, and God loves you. So, I think we get that. We're okay with that. Jesus, when it comes to sort of the more activistic way of life, the bringing about the kingdom of God, Jesus used parables like this one, where he says, he told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of the garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds come and perch in its branches. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into about 60 pounds of flour until it worked through all the dough. So, yeast and mustard seeds, small things, I think we're okay with that. And we believe it, right? We believe it. But we probably believe it at perhaps a more intellectual level of belief. Yeah, that's true. Jesus was about that. Mother Teresa seems like a really good person. She embodied that. But then there's another way of believing, which is trusting. Do we trust that way? Do we trust that that really is the way to live? Is that what's governing our lives, if you like? Is that the compass for us? And then I think we have to acknowledge that actually we're driven by some other philosophies, some other ways of thinking that aren't little. We're driven by a desire for greatness, right? We're driven, whether that's an internal thing or it's what's imposed on us by a culture that's a meritocracy. You get what you deserve. You have to earn your way. Whether it's from the inside or from the outside, I think we're pressured into trying to be great. Our ego kicks in, and our desire for significance kicks in. We're driven by ambition. And these things probably have a bigger impact on us than we realize. So we read something that Jesus says, but then we kind of default back to what's really moving us. And we've been talking in this series, again, about letting go. So some of this little way we're talking about requires us to be aware of our motivations and then letting some of those go. I think what happens with, say, take our ego, our desire for significance, what that leads us very often to disappointment, right? We try to prove ourselves to ourselves, to other people. We're trying to be significant, and the truth is that very often that doesn't happen. We don't get what we want. We don't accomplish all the things that we hope we would. And it can lead to disappointment, actually further loss of or lack of self-esteem, right? We beat ourselves up about what we haven't done. I can really identify that with that, especially in some recent months as I've been trying to be more mindful about my own approach to this. I realize that I'm much more obsessed by the things that I haven't done than what I have done. I'm much more obsessed by my lack of greatness than the presence of smallness, right? So that leads to us to it makes us beat ourselves up and to less self-esteem, which is what Saint Therese experienced. The drive for ambition or ambition that is not a bad thing, right? It's not a bad thing, and it's humanity has accomplished all kinds of things because of incredible ambition. But it can lead to, I think, a selfish approach to life where we're trying to outdo other people. We're trying to compete with other people, or we become less aware of other people's needs because we're trying to get here. We can tread on people, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not knowingly, in order to get towards what we hope will be greatness. And we become more obsessed, really, with... not so much what we've done, but is it better than the other person? Is it better, bigger, faster, whatever? How am I doing on the relative scale? So this issue of smallness and the small way, the small things, I think it is a massive challenge to us. But the reality is, I think smallness is the way to go. I think smallness is reality. I want to give some examples of this. Firstly, great people are in the minority, let's face it. If we analyze all of humanity and the people have done amazingly great things, it's a pretty low percentage. The odds are against us in that way. I mean, we're fighting against the odds, right? So some of it is just accepting, okay, it's okay to be a small person, right? Second thing, I want to use an example from nature. Many of you know I keep bees. The honeybee, you've probably heard me use this kind of analogy before. This is a pound of honey here, so with a chunk of honeycomb from my, I keep a couple of hives in my backyard at home. So that's a pound of honey. That, a honeybee, so there's a worker bee, goes out and collects nectar, only lives for about 7 weeks, and it will collect in its lifetime a 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey. That's all, in its whole lifetime. Now, there's about 30,000 bees in a hive, in a good, healthy hive. That pound of honey, okay, which is, I don't know whether you think that's a lot of honey or what, but it's to gather that much honey, it took the bees flying and visiting over 2 million flowers just in that little jar. And they had to fly, collectively, 55,000 miles. Right, to get one jar of honey there. So that in that jar, they've flown the equivalent collectively of twice around the circumference of the Earth, just to get a jar of honey. So this should make us all much more careful when we spread honey on our toast or whatever, because when you drop a little bit, I have some obsessive tendencies, by the way, so I'm like always trying to, because that's about 5 bees' lifetime work there going down there, when we put it in the dishwasher. But if we put 4 of those up there, they flew to the moon to get that. And a hive, a good hive, will yield 60 to 100 pounds of honey. Confession, I've never got that kind of yield, but maybe that says something about my beekeeping. But just imagine 100 pounds of honey from a hive, and there are people who do that. That's basically to the moon and back 12 times, right? So, and that's in one summer. That's just one season. And those bees don't all live to see the fruits of their labors, because most of the bees that, well, all the bees that are born in the spring will be dead by the end of the summer. So, you know, this is the fact that great things actually really only happen through the collective work of many small people, right? So when we're doing something, it's not about that great things don't matter, but we should put the value on the little thing that we do, because collectively it accomplishes so much more. And we can be more aware of and grateful for the collective, the fact that there are other people around us. It's not just about us and what we accomplish. Those bees, for instance, give up their lives for the hive and the ultimate goal of the hive, which is to produce and store honey. I mean, that's not necessarily their ultimate goal, but they need honey to get through the winter. So, you know, there's small things count. I think we see that in nature. Multiple small efforts bring about incredible change. Another illustration from nature. A couple of years ago, my wife and I went to Newfoundland. Has anybody ever been to Newfoundland? We drove there and back, which, you know, it was 4,000 miles round trip in the end, plus a 6-hour ferry ride. Right? We didn't quite know what we were getting into. I worked out that if we'd taken the same journey from London, we would have ended up in Afghanistan, right? On the road, not just direct flight or anything like that. So it was a long trip, but it was an amazing trip. And up in Newfoundland, there is some amazing geology. I really recommend going up there sometime. Maybe fly if you, you know. Really amazing geology. Here's a picture. This is Westernbrook Pond, which is like a Norwegian fjord, except it's a freshwater pond, because when the glaciers sort of ripped that great ravine there, as they receded, the end of the pond, or the end of the waterway, the earth bed popped back up again and sort of sealed it off from the sea. So it's actually it's fresh water. But you can probably see there's a little boat at the bottom there. We took a boat trip up that waterway. It's just, I mean, huge cliff, spectacular. That was formed over the last 3 million years by the multiple ice ages and progression of glaciers and recession of glaciers over a huge amount of time to bring about something really beautiful. Here's another picture. This is called the Tablelands, and it may not look all that dramatic, but you can see there on one side of the road, on the left there, is kind of barren, brown-looking rock. Right, that's not vegetation, that brown, it's just brown rock. And the irony is that, or the stark contrast is that on the other side of the road, it's just lush green. And if you walk out on those rocks, there's barely anything growing on there. There are actually a few things, but there's barely anything growing. It's very barren. And then just over the road, it's this lush green. And that's because that brown rock is actually the Earth's mantle. And it's one of the very few places on the Earth where the Earth's mantle, which is normally, by the way, about 30 miles down, 20 to 30 miles down, I think further in some parts of the Earth, below the Earth's crust, that got pushed up due to continental collisions somewhere around 600 million years ago, right? So that mantle was initially on the seabed of the Iapetus Ocean, which predates the Atlantic. So we're talking before Pangaea formed, you know, the great mass continent. And during the formation of Pangaea, these continents come together, there's a big collision, and it pushes all kinds of rock formations into all kinds of incredibly dramatic, we could show more pictures of just unbelievable dramatic geology. And it looks literally like in certain parts that there's just been an explosion. You could see these two things came together and it just and pushes all these rocks up. The only thing is, it took hundreds, or at least tens of millions of years to actually happen, right? In other words, that collision, which looks like it's gone like this to produce such an amazing effect, actually went like this. How long have you got? Can you just hang on? Okay, it went really, really slowly. Really, really slowly. So if I could time travel and go back there, and I'm going to get there for the beginning of the collision, put my deck chair down, you know, watch the collision happen, and then it's going a bit slow. I'll go away, you know, so maybe I go and see it when I'm 10 years old, and I go away, and then I think, for my 80th birthday, I'm going to go back to see the impact of that collision. I'll get back there, and I would think nothing has changed. It will look exactly the same, because it's just happening so slowly. maybe a few boulders here and there nudging, but so again, not only is our small things done cumulatively and together impactful, but we probably have to change our view of time, right? Have to have a different concept of time. I'm not saying we should have a geological concept of time, but it seems that more and more we're trying to do great things in the shortest amount of time possible. We're trying to read books as quick as we can. We're trying to analyze data as quick as we can. We're trying to have speedy relationships. But everything, we're trying to do it quickly because we don't want to miss out, right? We just don't want to miss out. Rather than perhaps through lingering more, we'll get more out of life. Perhaps by recognizing that, okay, my life doesn't just count right now. Maybe my actions and the investments I make in people and the love I share with other people around me is going to have an eternal impact, because those people themselves will then be different and can share that love, you know, generations from now, generations beyond then. That we would have more of a less individualistic, self-oriented mindset about what greatness is, and a more collective and long-term perspective one, which I think was what Jesus was talking about, because he would say things like, "You'll do greater things than me," and he was always talking about the future. And he was always sharing love with other people and empowering other people, rather than trying to do the great thing himself. That's the way of Jesus. So I think we have in nature these examples of how important the small things are. That perhaps that could motivate us and change this this philosophical approach of ours, this sort of drive of ours. What are the values of small things? Let's just run through a few of these. So the little way helps us take opportunities to incarnate love in small ways, right? We can be paralyzed by trying to do big, significant things. Take every little opportunity you can to love and show kindness. Just small things that maybe others don't even notice. Take simple first steps in practice. It makes it easy to do, right? It makes it easy to do. Find meaning in the reality and simplicity of love and kindness. Recognize that this isn't just do-gooding. It's not just a gimmick. It's not just some hallmark sentimentality. This is incarnating the very presence of God by loving the person next to us, by seeing, being aware of the need in front of us. See ourselves as part of something bigger, right? If we're focused on the big, it tends to all be about us. But if we're focused on the small, we have to acknowledge that other people are part of our lives, part of this human endeavor. Remove pressure to perform or be defined by accomplishments, right? How many of us, I mean, I walk around, like I said, think about all the things that I haven't done or haven't been able to do, not what I have done. If we could just take that pressure off, that would be amazing. And then still remain open to big things, right? It doesn't mean that big things or great things are bad. We're just not obsessed by them. They don't become our obsession, right? And I just a note on this, I think it's important that we recognize that a commitment to small things does not mean we're against big things. And in fact, in keeping with this, I think we need to recognize that there are issues in the world, for instance, that are big, and that just little kind acts are not going to solve. So, for instance, when we talk about social injustice, we talk about there are systems in place that are unjust, that it's greater than the sum of its parts. And so I think the flip side of this is that whatever small things we're doing, we need to recognize that we need to work in the context of the collective, that there are other people doing things, and we need to respect and love that. And sometimes we can do small things that may actually be unhelpful to or carry on empowering a system, right? If we don't address systems issues and we're not willing to look at the bigger issues of problems, not that we ourselves necessarily are going to be the ones to solve them all, but if we don't bear that in mind, then what can happen is we become obsessed with our little thing, and we begin to, it becomes about us. So it's a little thing, but it's my thing. And the flip side of this is that it lacks humility. It just becomes equally obsessive. Quick example of that, like back in at the end of the 80s, early 90s, when the Iron Curtain fell in Eastern Europe, a lot of people from churches in England started going out to these countries and would take loads of goods because they just wanted to help people. So like truckloads of goods going into Romania. And it really had a negative impact on the economy of that country. But some of the people did not want to stop doing it because they liked doing it. Because there's need and we want to help. And I think, honestly, you know, we feel good when we do those kinds of things. And probably what it needed, and eventually more of this happened, was just letting go of that and recognizing that, actually, it's not just about us. It's not just our thing. We're about something much bigger. But it became, if you like, the big thing to some people. So we've got to keep all this in context. Final thing I want to say about this, I want to come back to that good old name of Saint Thérèse, which is Saint Thérèse of the Child Jesus and the Holy Face. And Saint Thérèse's name is an epithet that was given to her when she entered, or when she became a novice in the convent, and that's very typical in many monasteries and in the Carmelite tradition. Initially, she was given just one epithet, and that was the Child Jesus. So, Saint Thérèse of the Child Jesus, and this is a focus on the sort of fragility and frailty of divinity, the fact that God would reside in human form, that God would take up presence in a child. And for Saint Thérèse, she was quite obsessed with this. Surprise, surprise. Because she would even say, how can anybody be afraid of God? This is in the later part of her life. How can anybody be afraid of God when God was a child? So there's this sort of beautiful sort of vulnerability to the essence of divinity, that the divine presence was incarnated in such vulnerability. She also requested that a second epithet would be added, which was the Holy Face. And that is this tradition of gazing upon the battered, bruised face of Jesus during the Passion. And again, the tradition can get a little wacky and a little obsessive, but the tradition really values the fact that the divine presence is incarnated in insignificance and suffering. If you get a chance, read the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, which many followers of Jesus believe has this prophetic reference to Jesus as being one who we barely notice, who's not very attractive, who bears suffering and pain. And there's references to the face in that beginning of that scripture, Isaiah 53. So really, I think this little way, these small things aren't just the little way of Saint Thérèse. They're actually the little way of Jesus. They are our way. I would summarize it like this, that our spirituality is not about power and control, but about love and sacrifice. Right? It's not having everything together. It's not about having everything together. It's not about controlling outcomes. It's not about doing great things. It's about love and sacrifice, and that often looks very small. Our faith is not about knowledge and certainty. We think we can control those kind of things. We have more knowledge about God, more knowledge about what it means to be really holy and all the rest of it. It's not about that. It's about trusting through our doubts and fears. Okay, in our imperfections, in our difficulties. That's what faith is about. Communion with God is not about success or perfection. Okay, so our communion with God, our oneness with God, is not about, oh, now we're accepted because we've got it all together and we didn't do anything wrong today. No, it's about humility and self-acceptance. Okay, accepting ourselves in our failures, in our sufferings, in our difficulties, and humbly not letting that create a barrier between us and God. Not withdrawing because we're not perfect. And then communion with one another is not about popularity or mutual comfort. It's not about, I really like that person. I feel a oneness with them. That's a little superficial, I guess, because we all get on with different people to different degrees, and that's fine. But it's not our union. The mystery of our union together is not about popularity or mutual comfort. It's not about how many likes we get. It's about patience and kindness. That's what I think Saint Thérèse is getting at. It's like, okay, you're splashing me, but I'm going to be patient about that. You offended me, but I'm going to be patient about that. I might need to have a conversation at some point, but I'm not going to react. I'm going to embody acceptance. So we're going to take communion now. Just as if, you know, we're going to do what we usually do. You know, we have crackers and fruit juice at the front and in the middle here, and we can help ourselves to that, serve one another. There'll be people at the sides who will appear who will serve us. They'll stand there and you can just line up and go there too. And we have would love to pray with you if you're feeling stressed or just got a weight on your shoulders this morning and you want somebody to pray with you. We'll be at the back of the room, a few of us, and we'll love to pray with you. You can write out a prayer, and there's a little window under Journey and Grow, those banners over there. You can write it out, roll it up, stick it in there, and we'll pray for you during the week. You can give a financial offering. You can light a candle. You can sit where you are and sing. You can really pretty much do whatever you want as a way to respond in this moment. But let's just hold a moment of silence before we do that. Maybe we can just put the lights down a little bit and close our eyes. And before we go into communion, let's just sit and let's be conscious in this moment of the kind of weight that is on our shoulders. Like we feel all kinds of responsibilities. We feel all kinds of pressures to have done something with our lives. We have all kinds of fears about what might happen or not happen. We don't want to be failures. We don't want to be losers. We don't want to be a disappointment to ourselves or others or God. And those things can just weigh on us. And so let's just, for a moment, just be aware of that. The kind of pressure we might feel under. And in that awareness, let's just center ourselves on our breathing. Just breathe in and out. Just notice your breathing. Center yourself in this moment. Be present to yourself with perhaps that weight, even that pressure. And as we breathe in, let's just breathe in God's acceptance. Complete. It is not affected by anything we have done or not done. It's complete in this moment. Just breathe it in. And as we breathe out, let's let go of that burden. Let's let go of that weight. So breathe in God's love and let go on the out-breath of pressure and weight. Now, you may just want to stay there in that prayerful place. That's good. We may want to come and have communion or do any of those other things. So when you're ready, please come forward.